Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. I hope everyone was able to tune in for John's segments on marijuana in California and the Supreme Court's latest take on the crack powder sentencing problem and textualism and how that is intersected. But we're going to jump from the West Coast to the East Coast now and talk about a case that the New Civil Liberties Alliance has been pursuing for the better part of a year now. And I've invited our colleague, Jared McLean, to join us to talk about a brief that he has just filed in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And before I pose a question to Jared, I'll just give a little bit of background on this case. The case began, as many of the pandemic lockdown sort of cases have begun, with an executive order from the governor of New Jersey, Philip Murphy. And what Governor Murphy did was he issued an executive order that purported to be able to change the terms of every rental contract in the entire state of New Jersey overnight. And what the executive order stated was that even though virtually all of these rental contracts have a stipulation in them that the renter has to have a security deposit and that the person renting the unit keeps that in the bank and then can subtract any damages from that before returning the security deposit at the end of the lease. Governor Murphy's executive order said people could apply that security deposit to the rent before the end of the lease. And the Governor Murphy's logic was, well, you know, the person, the renter owns that money anyway. And so this is just going to help people not be evicted, help people pay their rent. It really helps everyone. It's not a problem. But that's not really what happened. And here to explain, or at least that's not really the effect that the executive order had. So here to explain more about that, Jared McLean, thank you for joining us on Administrative Static. Good to have you with us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, so that's the background of what Governor Murphy did. Explain to us, You're now in the Third Circuit. So how did you get there? What's been the sort of procedural path in sort of shorthand, if you will?
Yes, it's been a winding road. We filed our initial complaint in the federal court in New Jersey now over a year ago on June 2nd of 2020. And the state had sort of slowed the process. They didn't want we filed claims under both the federal constitution and the state constitution, and the state didn't want the state law claims to proceed in federal court. So we then had to split the case, and we filed a separate case in New Jersey state courts. And then we proceeded with our federal claims at the federal court, and the case sort of sat there stagnant for until February of this year. So
Felt a little bit like the judge was waiting for someone else to issue a decision somewhere else that he could just kind of follow.
It really did. And that's exactly what the judge did do, because in his decision, which ruled against us, he dismissed our case relying solely on federal trial courts in other states that had dealt with other similar orders. But
with different statutory schemes, since they were from other states, obviously.
Correct. Different statutory schemes, different sources of authority, and the orders were all different. The order in New York, for instance, only applied to certain tenants, and you had to make a certain showing in order to invoke the order. And in New Jersey, it literally rewrote all of the residential leases, regardless of need, regardless of whether you were out of work or any other thing that might require you to need assistance during the pandemic.
Yeah, no showing at all. And in fact, when Governor Murphy was asked about the constitutional implications of some of his executive orders, he said, "Oh, that's above my pay grade. Those those pesky constitutional questions about whether my authority is valid or not in what I'm doing, which I thought was a pretty unfortunate statement for an elected official to make.
Right. He said he did not consider the Bill of Rights when issuing his executive orders.
Wow. Wow. That's no, he did not. I think it was a truthful statement on his part that he did not. But although as it happens, the particular violation that the New Civil Liberties Alliance is pursuing here. And if I didn't mention it, the name of the case is Johnson v. Governor of New Jersey. It was Johnson v. Murphy, who is the governor of New Jersey in the district court. But it's Johnson v. Governor of New Jersey in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which oversees New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware. What I started to say, Jared, is that the particular issue isn't a Bill of Rights claim. Really, it's the Contracts Clause of the federal Constitution. Explain to us how that's involved here and why the executive order violates the Contracts Clause.
That's right, Mark. And I think the fact that it is a Contracts Clause case makes this more of a salient and more of a widespread issue than just something having to do with residential security deposits in New Jersey. The Contracts Clause basically says that a state cannot impair a private contract. So it gives the federal government oversight over state laws that may impair private contracts. And what we said was by nullifying express terms of our clients' leases, the governor has impaired those contracts. Our clients contracted to have a pot of money set aside and held in escrow during the duration of their lease so that if there's any damage to their private property during the tenancy, they can repair that damage without having to chase down the tenant, without having to have the delay and extra cost of going through litigation to get that money back before they can then relet the property. And that's something that both of the contracting parties agreed to up front. And Governor Murphy came in and said, I'm going to change the terms of all the residential leases. You can no longer rely on that deposit as security to protect your property. And the reason he says that he's allowed to do that is because there has been past regulation of residential leases in New Jersey. So under the governor's theory, anytime the state government has any type of regulation within an industry, all of the people who participate in that industry are put on notice that the state might come in and nullify the terms of their contracts.
Now that's just bizarre because he's right that these residential leases have been subject to regulation before, but the particular regulation was in the exact opposite direction. The one thing in the law that protected landlords or housing providers was the fact that they could get these security deposits, and they were allowed to have them, I think, up to 1.5 months rent.
That's
under state statute that they could have as a security deposit. So to completely wipe out that part of the what was a presumably carefully negotiated legislative arrangement, mostly protecting tenants, but giving housing providers this one thing, to then snatch that one thing away, that isn't something that I think you could fairly say housing providers should have expected to have happen.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Going back to the early 1900s, if not the late 1800s, New Jersey courts have recognized the rights of housing providers to contract for a security deposit. And in the 1960s, the New Jersey legislature passed a law putting a cap on how big that deposit could be. And then there were a couple amendments. There were about six amendments over 50 years saying, well, that has to be held in escrow. If you lose your property to foreclosure during the tenancy, what happens to the property? So there were some minor technical changes over how the security deposit is held. But as Mark mentioned, there, no one in the right to hold a security deposit has not been questioned for well over a century in New Jersey until now.
Right. Yeah. Until Governor Murphy got a hold of it. One of the things that I liked about your brief, Jared, the district court had essentially said that, you couldn't, that the landlords not only should have expected this, but that the landlords were, I'm trying to remember the exact wording that the district court used, but it's not coming to mind.
That they wouldn't lose a nickel?
No, but I'll come back to it if I remember the verbiage. But let me ask you a different question, which is that the state is claiming that this case is moot because the legislature has now ended the emergency in New Jersey. And this little trick has been tried all around the country, different governors saying, oh, well, now that the lawsuit has reached the stage or has reached a court where I'm afraid I might lose, I'm going to magically end the emergency and avoid losing this case in court. Why isn't it moot? It seems right to me that the housing providers are still suffering under this law.
The housing providers are still suffering. And what the governor said was, I'm ending the public health emergency and all of the executive orders, except a handful that the legislature has singled out and said can stay in place. All of those orders will end 30 days after the public health emergency ends, which just happens to be Independence Day. And so most people will now be free from all Governor Murphy's orders as of July 4th of this year.
I predict many fireworks from housing providers.
Yeah, the problem is that Executive Order 128, the one that we're dealing with here, was particularly pernicious. It had some poison pills in it, basically. And under the terms of the order, if a tenant invokes the order and requires the housing provider to move the security deposit toward rent, that change is permanent for the duration of the lease. And if the housing provider then renews the lease, which most of them are doing since there's an eviction moratorium in place and they're not permitted to evict their tenants. So if they renew the lease, then they can't.
And that's not just the federal eviction moratorium we've talked about on the show before. There's a state New Jersey eviction moratorium in place as well.
That's correct. And with the help of the legislature, Governor Murphy has extended the eviction moratorium through at least January of 2022. So housing providers aren't in a place where they can evict their tenants, and they're going to need to renew their leases to continue any hope of getting rental income. And if they do renew their lease, Executive Order 128 continues to govern their lease for 6 months after the expiration of the public health emergency. So we're talking December 4th that this executive order is going to stay in place.
It seems pretty clear to me that it's not moot. I'm glad that that the New Civil Liberties Alliance is continuing to pursue Governor Murphy on this, and we'll keep the audience posted on what happens with this security deposit litigation. Welcome back to Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione. Vec, hot off the presses, we have a decision from the United States Supreme Court in a case in which the New Civil Liberties Alliance filed an amicus brief. Now, by the time this airs, it'll be a couple days later, so folks may have heard about this already. But in the case of Fulton v. City of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the Supreme Court handed down a unanimous decision, which from this court is surprising, and particularly given what was the underlying subject matter of this case, I think it's surprising. The case,
I was surprised.
Yeah, there you go. Well, and so the case had to do with Philadelphia's foster care system and the role of Catholic social services in that system. It's a centuries old mission of the Catholic Church to serve needy people, and including foster care families, and to provide foster care services, particularly in Philadelphia. Catholic Social Services has been contracting with the city to provide foster care services for over half a century. And yet,
and they did it on their own for 200 years.
Oh, yeah, they did it on their own right before there was sort of a city or a municipal program in place. Catholic Social Services was doing this independently for some period of time, but now it's a contractor with the city. But in recent years, as the issue of same-sex marriage has grown in prominence, there has been a controversy brewing in the city of Philadelphia because Catholic Social Services sticks to the beliefs of the Catholic Church that marriage is a sacred bond between a man and a woman. And for that reason, CSS believes that certification of foster families, or I guess it would be prospective foster families, requires a kind of endorsement of their relationship. So even though CSS would be willing to refer anyone who came to them, any sort of same-sex couple that came to them, CSS would refer to one of the many other providers of foster care services in the city for certification. CSS is not willing to certify such folks themselves, again, because they view it as a kind of endorsement of that same-sex relationship in violation of the Catholic Church's teachings. So it's by the way, Catholic Social Services also won't certify unmarried couples who presumably it would think are living in sin, or that premarital sex would also be sinful.
Opposite sex couples who are unmarried, correct?
Right, right. And so regardless of their sexual orientation there, the CSS won't certify. So the city, as a result of this policy of Catholic Social Services, the city had informed CSS that unless it agreed to certify same-sex couples, it would no longer refer children to the agency. And the city said that the refusal to certify same-sex married couples violated a non-discrimination provision in the agency's contract with the city, as well as the non-discrimination requirements of a citywide ordinance involving fair practices. So Catholic Social Services and some of the foster parents that CSS serves filed suit seeking to enjoin the city's referral freeze under free exercise and free speech grounds of the First Amendment. And here I should pause to give credit to our friends over at the Beckett Fund, who are the ones who brought this case and represented Catholic Social Services and these foster families. I think this means that that Beckett's record at the Supreme Court is still untarnished. Are they 8-0, 9-0, something
they were
like that?
7, they're, and I think this is 8. I might have missed one.
It's an impressive record, to be sure. So congratulations to our friends over at the Beckett Fund. But you know, they lost this case at the district court and at the Third Circuit. The district court had denied a preliminary relief. It had found under a case from a famous case from the 1990s, Employment Division v. Smith, that the non-discrimination requirement and the Fair Practices Ordinance were neutral and generally applicable. And under
why don't you tell people what Smith was and why that's such a big deal?
Yeah, so Smith essentially narrowed the First Amendment, this whole concept of free exercise, because it said, Smith said that as long as a law is neutral and generally applicable, it's okay if it infringes the free exercise of religion, which was surprising to folks.
And what far lefty who doesn't care about our rights wrote that?
Yeah, that was Justice Scalia who came up with that idea. And it imported this notion of neutrality in the First Amendment, which isn't really there in the text of the First Amendment. So it was surprising. And I'm not enough of a First Amendment scholar to really understand what was driving Justice Scalia's thought process there. But suffice it to say that this neutrality is useful in some contexts, but it's really has created a huge problem in other contexts.
And I think I can add to that. I think that he believed it would burden the courts too much if they had to provide exceptions to all these kinds of laws. But there was an almost immediate reaction to Smith, a legislative reaction.
Right. Yeah. The Congress of the United States and Bill Clinton signed the law to sort of partially, I wouldn't say overturn or repeal Smith, but certainly to create some exceptions.
So for federal laws, you have to make an accommodation, but you don't for states.
Or cities.
Here. Correct. Yeah. And that's why we're here. And so was Smith overturned, Mark?
No, Smith was not overturned. That was one of the questions before the court in Fulton. And by the way, had there been a majority to overturn Smith, we would not have seen a unanimous result here. So this is one of those Chief Justice Roberts opinions writing for the court and managing to cobble together 9 votes in one direction. But there are also, I should quickly add, there are some concurrences in judgment here that are shall we say, less enamored with the reasoning of the majority opinion. So we had Justice Alito filed an opinion concurring in the judgment in which Thomas and Gorsuch joined, and Gorsuch filed an opinion concurring in the judgment in which Thomas and Alito joined. But you have Chief Justice Roberts, Breyer, Sotomayor, Kagan, Kavanaugh, and Barrett all joining the Chief Justice's opinion in the case. So that's a pretty good degree of unanimity.
It's unanimity. It's also an interesting for Barrett. All the things we heard about Barrett beforehand certainly didn't come to fruition in this hot button case. She's on the Kagan side.
Well, I will say she wrote separately, and I haven't read her. Okay. I haven't read her concurrence yet. So she may have.
She might have some nuance,
or she might have left it open for future, or something like that. So I don't want to. I don't want to jump too quickly to a conclusion there. But let me in the time we have left, talk a little bit about the holding that Chief Justice Roberts did cobble together here, because I do think even though they didn't overturn Smith, and you're right to point that out, Vec, I think what they did here is interesting, particularly maybe from an administrative state perspective. And the holding of the case is that the refusal of Philadelphia to contract with CSS for the provision of foster care services unless CSS agrees to certify same-sex couples as foster parents violates the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. And the court explicitly did not reach the free speech claim that was in the case. They didn't need to once they found that there was a free exercise claim. So the court said that the city's actions burdened CSS's religious exercise by forcing it to either curtail its mission or to certify same-sex couples as foster parents in violation of its religious beliefs. So we see there the same kind of putting a religious person to a choice that we saw in like Little Sisters of the Poor and another Beckett case that the court doesn't like.
And the
Masterpiece Cake Shop, right? So this has that same flavor to it. But rather than overturn Smith, Chief Justice Roberts said this case falls outside of Smith because the city has burdened CSS's religious exercise through policies that do not satisfy the threshold requirement of being neutral and generally applicable. A law is not generally applicable if it invites the government to consider the particular reasons for a person's conduct by creating a mechanism for individualized exemptions. So here, the city had set up a system where it did give exemptions to some folks, but it wasn't willing to give an exemption to Catholic social services or an exemption on religious grounds. There were other grounds on which it would give exemptions, but not that one. And so the court decided that where there's a system of individual exemptions in place, the government cannot refuse to extend the system to cases of religious hardship without a compelling reason. The non-discrimination requirement of the city's foster care contract is not generally applicable, the court said, and because the inclusion of a mechanism for entirely discretionary exceptions renders the non-discrimination provision not generally applicable, which I think makes sense. And to toot NCLA's own horn here a little bit, one of the arguments that we made in our amicus brief was that the court didn't need to overturn Smith in order to find that this particular exercise on the part of the city of Philadelphia violated the free exercise clause. On pretty similar grounds to this, we said that, look, this isn't generally applicable. And this sort of administrative exemptions regime is fraught with violating of religious liberties.
It wasn't accidental.
No, it wasn't accidental. And it wasn't a generally applicable law in that sense. I mean, they adopted what they adopted precisely to exclude CSS from this. If you look at the timing of this, and that's one of the things the court does talk about, the timing a little bit. And the court also looks to state law and says that state law makes it clear that the city's authority to grant exceptions, governs the general prohibition on sexual orientation discrimination as well, and that the contract as a whole contains no generally applicable non-discrimination requirement. The court also looked at the Fair Practices Ordinance, came to much the same conclusion there, saying it forbids interfering with public accommodation opportunities of an individual based on sexual orientation. But then the court says that this sort of certification isn't really a public accommodation because it's not made available to the public in the sense of your typical public accommodation. It's not readily accessible to the public. It's more of a customized and selective assessment that bears little resemblance to staying in a hotel or eating at a restaurant or riding a bus. And that the district court's conclusion to the contrary didn't take into account the uniquely selective nature of foster care certification. So there we see Chief Justice Roberts narrowing the opinion a little bit, and looked at both on the contractual side and on the ordinance side. the court was able to fashion the decision here, suggesting that it wasn't under Smith, it wasn't neutral, and therefore they struck it down. But still, we have a unanimous court upholding the Catholic Social Services' right to provide foster care in the